Welcome to the fourth episode of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. My name is Steve Vanderark. I'm the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website, and we're going to poke around through Harry Potter canon for a little while. Before we do that, I just want to again thank Harry and the Potters for providing the music for the opening. That song, by the way, is called Save Ginny Weasley from Dean Thomas, and it's from their Power of Love CD, and I really appreciate being able to use that. Before we go on, start talking about some other things. This is being recorded on July the 19th, the week after the Deathly Hallows Part 2 came out. And I do want to give a few comments about the movie. I'm not going to give a review as such, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. But I did kind of make a little list of some of the things that I noticed, and some of them are good and some of them are not so good, but I'm just going to run through this list. They're not in any particular order. They're just kind of as I thought of them. The first thing is the scene with Gringotts I thought was absolutely brilliant. I thought it was spot on. I can't believe they even included the thief's downfall. The Gemino curse was amazing, the way that stuff just kept building up. I thought it was just beautiful. The only thing I didn't like was the guards looked modern. I mean, they looked like police officers or, I don't know, Gestapo or something like that. I would have liked to have seen them more dressed as wizards and not like muggles. But let's see. Another thing was I appreciated the fact, and this is partly just because they had two films, but they had time in the films to actually have conversations. They didn't have to rush through things like the conversation with Ollivander and with Griphook at the beginning, just to kind of take the time to flesh out some of the underlying ideas behind the Hallows and the Horcruxes. And of course, in the book, it goes into a lot more detail about Harry's dilemma of which one to choose, which I think is very important, obviously, because it ties into the whole purpose of the wands and all that stuff. But I thought they did a good job of spending the time to develop that part of it. Another one I liked was when Luna finally had enough and demanded that Harry stop running up the stairs and stop and listen to her. I thought that was brilliant. Wonderful. I love the character of Luna, and I love her in this film. I thought she was great. Not keen on the Neville Luna romance thing that they kind of put in there, but I love that little bit there where she finally just kind of, you could see her almost stamp her feet and say, stop. I love the scene in the Room of Requirement. I like the one when they came in and they were all, in the hammocks and things like this, although there was nothing, I don't think that really said that was the Room of Requirement, but that was supposed to be as well. But I love the one which turned into, of course, the firestorm, but just the fact that the Cornish pixies started kind of sneaking out and all of a sudden there's a whole flock of them. I want to see the film again and this time pay close attention and try to look for other little details. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if I can spot a few more odds and ends from previous films that are, in that set somewhere. So I'll have to watch next time I see it. And if any of you have spotted things and remember that, drop me a line. I'd really like to know what to look for. Wonderful, wonderful scene. I just thought that was very, very, very well done. I thought Snape, Alan Rickman as Snape, absolutely amazing. And the way they staged his death, kind of behind that translucent glass so that it wasn't, I mean, that's a really gory death, and the way they did it had that shock value of the impact of the snake, but you didn't have to actually watch it in all of its gory detail, which I thought was well done, and which might explain why they didn't go to the Shrieking Shack with it, why they did it in the boathouse, because they could put a that glass there. Could also be they didn't feel like trying to build that Shrieking Shack set again, because that, with the moving doors and all that kind of stuff, that's quite a set. I just love Neville through the whole film. He's wonderful. that's just wonderful. And of course, I loved him in the book too. And to see him just really shine in the film was terrific. And yeah, they didn't do the snake scene with Neville quite the same, but I thought it was great the way, he's kind of the chasing, trying, both Hermione and Ron are trying as hard as they can to try to fight him, and they he's going to win, and boom, there comes Neville. Fantastic. I thought that was really great. One scene I didn't think was all that great was Molly fighting Bellatrix. And my wife and I have talked about this, too. I mean, it was okay, but, oh, man, it should have been. I mean, if you read the book, the stones underneath their feet are cracking from the violent energies of this battle. And, you know, it just felt like it wasn't quite crazed enough to suit me. I think Molly should have been a little bit more, you know, in total, you know, mom defending her kids mode. And it, I don't know. It was okay. It was all right. And of course, they got the obligatory line in there, which they had to, you know. But I would have liked to have seen that be a little bit more of a big deal. They could have taken a little bit away from the endless dueling with Harry and Voldemort, which, of course, you know, in the book, there's no dueling at all. So, you know, they might have taken a couple seconds off of that and given it to Molly and Bellatrix, but there you go. McGonagall was wonderful. I love her casting the spell on the statues and then turning to Molly and saying, "I've always wanted to cast that spell." That was wonderful. I mentioned the battle between Harry and Voldemort. Again, why is there the priori incantatum effect between their two wands? You know, there's no reason for that. The only reason that happened before was because they share a wand core. It wasn't because it was Harry and Voldemort. So it doesn't make any sense that they would suddenly be in the midst of this same, you know, Goblet of Fire-style, graveyard-style battle. It shouldn't be. They both had different wands at this point. So it doesn't make any sense, but I guess it doesn't really matter. But, you know, again, I was always kind of wondering how they were going to get all this wand lore, wand ownership stuff into the film, I guess they did it that way and kind of figured, oh, well, it's going to just have to do. And I guess it'll just have to do. So I'm not quite sure what spell everybody is firing that makes, you know, Bellatrix and Voldemort break into little tiny pieces. I don't remember any spell like that in the books. But somehow in the book, having Voldemort get hit and just sort of topple over, and she describes it as just being this kind of almost a hollow shell kind of a thing. I do like that. I like that sense of the fact that in the end he's just nothing, and then they just go and dump his body in a corner because they don't want to have him, you know, by the bodies of all the other people who died fighting him. Anyway, I'll have to see it again, but I don't. Did Harry cast an Expelliarmus there? You know, did he, or was it another one of his? Was it one of these fancy spells that makes people break into little pieces? I don't know. the scenes of Godric's Hollow with Lily telling baby Harry how much he is loved before she sacrifices herself, and then Snape weeping over her. Oh, just absolutely wonderful stuff. Just very, very well done. Let's see. The ending on the bridge, all three of them standing there looking, you know, into the distance. I mean, why couldn't they go back to Dumbledore's office like it says in the books and have the ex-headmasters and the portraits clap? That would have been a perfect ending. And instead, to have them stand there on the bridge, it felt like the end of, you know, movie 6 again, where they all stand there looking into the distance. But so I didn't care for that so much. I wish they would have done it the other way. I love the Malfoys walking quickly away through the remains, just trying to get out of there. It's very, very well done. I mean, in the book, of course, they're sitting in the common room, but I do like the idea of them just sort of walking away quickly and trying to escape the whole situation. And the way that they did, Mrs. Malfoy running over to check on Harry without being told, because that seemed a little bit like, boy, that was lucky that Voldemort told, you know, her to do it. You know, in this case, she, without being told, ran ahead to check, which, okay, that makes a little more sense. It makes it feel a little bit less like it was contrived, that she would be the one to check if Harry was dead. You know, then you see she ran forward on purpose because she wanted to know if Malfoy was still alive. And again, it's the fact that Harry went back to rescue Malfoy, the fact that he, you know, love wins the day again. He went back and rescued his enemy, and that's what saved him in that case. That's, you know, just one more example of that. I loved, I don't know if that's the word, but this visuals of Hogwarts turned into, the only thing I could think of was a prison camp, you know, where there's no tables, everybody marches in formation, and just marvelous. Oh, just wonderful. Just that whole picture's just chilling, because, you know, we have this feeling of especially the Great Hall of this warm, wonderful, you know, place we all want to visit. I mean, and it feels, I was on that set, and it feels that way. You know, in fact, I remember walking down the and looking at the tables, and there's carvings on the tables from all those kids that have been, that were sitting there for all these filmings, and they just sit there and, you know, bored, waiting for the cameras to roll and things, and they're carving their names in the tables and things like this. It just has that feeling of being a real, I don't know, real school, a real place where people live and people are, and then to have that set, you know, just sort of stripped and people standing there like that. It seemed, I don't know, it seemed bigger in the film than it does when you're actually walking into it. But then when you walk into it, I don't know, maybe there's, it's because it's, because you know it's a set or something like that. And of course, there's no magical sky, sad to say. And then one more thing. Absolutely hilarious. At the very end, Hogwarts is in ruins. Everyone's sitting around trying to recover from the battle. And Filch starts to sweep up. Just wonderful. Absolutely delightful moment. So, that's just some things I noticed about the film. Absolutely love it. I can't wait to see it again. There's so many little details that I know I missed because it all goes by so fast. This is going to be another one that I'm going to want to see a couple of times in the theater and then probably freeze frame it a lot when I get the DVD. So, but had to talk about that. But we want to move into some other things. Let's talk a little bit more. Last time I talked about, for sources, I talked a little bit about what canon is. I talked about, you know, using interviews and things like this. We've talked about the Daily Prophet newsletters. I want to talk a little bit today about the famous wizard cards. And, you know, it is interesting. This is definitely open for debate of whether these things are to be included in the official canon or not. And, you know, we know they are written by J.K. Rowling. And, you know, I definitely would include this in canon a lot more than I would ever include anything from the films or the games, because we know it's written by Rowling. And because, you know, looking at these cards, and just a little background, these things were actually originally created for the Chamber of Secrets video game for Electronic Arts. The folks from Electronic Arts, when they needed something like this, they decided to have some sort of a reward or something to be searching for in the castle in the game. And Rowling herself, anything that's newly created for the game is actually done by Rowling. And she has said that she wrote these cards, and so she made this list of 100 of cards, famous wizard cards, which are kind of based on the chocolate frog cards. We kind of use those phrases kind of interchangeably. And so the original 100, or 101, I think, because Harry Potter was 101, were originally created for the Chamber of Secrets video game. And then with the subsequent games, a Prisoner of Azkaban game, they added famous vampire cards, famous goblin cards, famous hag cards, famous giant cards. And so those cards got added to it. Now, the Goblet of Fire game, the cards they had in there were not the same. They weren't the famous wizard cards. They were actually cards that would give kind of power-ups to the characters. So those are a little different. Those didn't have any canon facts on them. And then, of course, starting with Order of the Phoenix game, they kind of took a different track entirely. They went off to on the idea of exploring the castle and kind of reliving the game that way, or reliving the story that way, which I loved. That's, you know, of all the other ones, I messed around with some, but Order of the Phoenix, I played it all the way through because I just loved that game. I loved that feeling of just sort of wandering around and exploring the castle and kind of feeling like you knew your way a little bit. When you'd see things, you'd know where to go without having to be told, you know, by the in-game prompts and things. So, I don't know, I really enjoyed that. I still think it would be a great setup to do some sort of a online role-playing game kind of a thing. I don't know if they'll ever do that, but it would be, I think it would be fantastic if they would. So these famous wizard cards, what I like about them is that they give us this, they give us a lot of little minor character kinds of things, that's true, but what they also give us is they give us this kind of sweep of history, you might say. They give us the the things that happened like in prehistory or ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, things like that. And then they move through the founding of Hogwarts, and then they move up until kind of the present time. And by looking at the cards and looking at the facts on the cards and the dates on the cards, that's you can put together quite a nice timeline, and not just for the sake of having a timeline. But in this case, it's for the sake of kind of seeing how the Wizarding World became what it is in the book. So if you see the books and you see the world of Harry Potter and of our all the people that we know in the books, it's come kind of formed through a logical process. See, the thing that you really notice if you look at the cards, and also if you look at Tales of Beedle the Bard and Quidditch Through the Ages and Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, if you go through and look through all of those, you see that the overriding idea that Rowling is developing in this history is the idea of prejudice. And so if you look at it, I'll kind of go through a little bit of kind of the main, I don't know, the main periods in wizarding history before the 20th century, and which is kind of the Voldemort era. It starts with, if you go back to ancient times, you've got ancient wizards which show up in the cards. You also have, of course, references to, the Weasleys going to Egypt because they go and they try to get treasure out of the pyramids and things. Through all of these references, it's clear that in ancient Egypt, in Greece, wizards were accepted. They were part of society. And in quite a different connection to the Muggle world than we have now. It's almost like there wasn't a separate Muggle world, Wizarding world. It was just all one world, if you will. And then, but of course, there was already dark wizardry then, because Herpo the Foul is from ancient Greece, and he is the originator of the Basilisk, for example, and the Horcrux. He was the one who originally developed that magic. So yeah, Herpo the Foul was already, there was the dark magic and the dark wizard stuff happening back then. But wizardry was kind of integrated right into society. Now, sometime between that and about 1000 AD, that would be when persecution was, or at least discrimination was, to the point where the four founders of Hogwarts decided to build their school far away from Muggle habitation. And you have to remember that this in the Highlands of Scotland, in 985 or whatever it was, 86, whenever this was built, there were no castles anywhere in Britain, certainly not in Scotland, but nowhere. I mean, the first castles came in 1066. So there's no castles. This is an entirely new kind of construction, assuming that they built a castle from the very beginning and it hasn't magically morphed over time, which I guess we can't assume that, but there were not even any towns in Scotland in the 900s. So this is, if you think of when they went up there to build to start the school, they were going into absolutely no civilization at all. And so that was why they decided. Now notice also, though, we're talking about just before 1000 AD, already prejudice or discrimination from Muggles led to them to want to separate the school from Muggle society. But then prejudice between the four of them, or between Slytherin and Gryffindor particularly, already starting to color wizarding society. And that's fascinating because, you think about it, the wizarding world, as Harry discovers, not so much in book one, but starting in book two, he starts to realize that house elves are discriminated against. And it's interesting because the wizarding world, the discrimination is like different. There's very little gender discrimination. I mean, Elfrida Clegg became head of the Warlock or Wizards Council in the mid 1300s. And she was at a very enlightened rule. And already in 1798, Artemisia Lufkin became the first witch to become Minister of Magic, for example. It was 1979 before Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister. So we're talking hundreds of years ahead of where the Muggle society is in terms of gender prejudice, although there's a lot of kind of comic gender prejudice built into the stories and the cards and things like this. But But also, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any, ethnic discrimination. I mean, you look at the different ethnicities that are present at Hogwarts. You have, Angelina Johnson, Dean Thomas are black. You've got Cho Chang and the Patil twins are different kind of ethnicities. And there doesn't seem to be the slightest bit of even notice or it's just not a factor. And then, instead, you have prejudice against Muggleborns. You have prejudice against, half-bloods. You have prejudice. You know, the pure-blood prejudice is there. You also have this prejudice against house elves, goblins. So, I mean, we're talking about eras in wizarding history. You've got 1200, 1300. You've got the Wizards Council. That was kind of the predecessor of the Ministry of Magic. That ran all the way through from all the way until the establishment of the International Statute of Secrecy. But in between there, the prejudice kind of comes and goes, but it's generally building all along. You've got, at the same time that wizards are getting sort of persecuted, at the same time you have wizards themselves oppressing house elves and goblins, because... for example, in the 1400s, Beetle the Bard wrote his tales of Beetle the Bard in the 1400s. The real kind of overriding idea to those tales was to promote tolerance of muggles and muggles and wizards getting along and things like this. And if you read the notes, the Dumbledore's notes in Tales of Beetle the Bard, you really get a sense of that. So that's the 1400s. 1492... Nearly Headless Nick is a court wizard. I mean, known to be a magic wizard. I mean, this is in 1492, and he made a mistake with a spell and ended up getting beheaded because they took his wand away. But, they knew he was a wizard. So this is 1492. And then you get to 1600s, you've got Goblin Rebellion. So you've got the wizards oppressing goblins and... at the same time being oppressed by muggles. 1637, you have the Werewolf Code of Conduct, so you have werewolves being discriminated against. Although, to be honest with you, I can understand that a little bit more than others, because werewolves are dangerous. So, and that was before the invention of the Wolfsbane potion, so yeah, I think some sort of code of conduct is probably, or maybe, in order anyway, although, that is just an example, though, of how... And that was not the Ministry of Magic yet. That would still have been the Wizards Council, was trying to control the non-wizard populations. Now, the International Statute of Secrecy, according to Quidditch Through the Ages, that was put in place when Muggle persecution was at its height. That's from Chapter 6. Now, it's interesting because the date is 1692 in Quidditch Through the Ages several times. It's in the Third Wombat Test. It's listed as 1692. In Fantastic Beasts, it's 1692. But in Deathly Hallows, Chapter 16, it's 1689. And Tales of Beetle the Bard, it's also listed as 1689. So I'm not sure what happened, whether somebody's notes got a little mixed up. Between one set of canon information and another. I guess that since we usually accept the novels as, the sort of the most canon, if you will, then we're going to have to go with 1689. Maybe it just means that it took a couple of years to put all the information together. That's a good within-the-story answer for that discrepancy. But be that as it may, just before 1700 is when the International Statute of Secrecy went into effect. Ministry of Magic is created. 1709, dragon breeding is outlawed. But it wasn't until 1750 that the Department of Games and Sports was created, that each country became responsible for the control of their own magical creatures. So it was a process of kind of creating a functioning government in secrecy to make sure that... You know, this is the international agreement, so that kind of work out agreements and so with other countries' ministries and things like that. So yeah, that. But again, that kind of all that history, and if you look at all the famous wizard cards and how they fit into there, you see that they kind of flesh out enrich that timeline of wizarding history. And again, Rowling is putting together this history which defines the time of the books. So when we read the books, we're reading stories happening in a culture which has a history, which has background to it, which makes certain things make sense, which is really, it's brilliant. So I definitely would say that these various things are canon. They're definitely from Rowling. They fit right in. They give us the background and the color that we need. And almost without fail, there are not errors. I mean, she did a masterful job with this. You know, all through the books, when you consider the scope of this and the kinds of details that she put in, if you think about, it's amazing how few errors there are. It really is amazing. And there's no way around the fact that she has done an incredible job of creating this magical, believable, magical world. And this is part of it. So again, now thinking about prejudice, for example, when you see Harry starting to realize what the wizarding world is really like, the fact that there is this dark side to the wizarding world, and he sees it, in the first book, he's just sees it, against wizards by the Dursleys, that prejudice, and I guess between houses. But then in book two, he starts to see where house elves are being discriminated against and treated badly. And then in the fact that, mudbloods, as Draco comes out with, he starts to learn about the prejudices of purebloods and halfbloods and things. In book three, just the injustice of the Ministry of Magic. So he starts to see again the dark side of this world that he's a part of. And all of these interesting because the house elves, he sees it because he sees the prejudice against Dobby, someone who he cares about, against Sirius, and against Hagrid and Buckbeak. In each case, the injustice that he sees is against someone or some character or some person that he cares about. And then again, book four, you've got house elves, but he doesn't really. Spew doesn't really resonate with him that much, but this whole idea of this foreign wizards. He listens to Hagrid talk about how foreign wizards are not to be trusted, or don't connect with them. And he, as a Triwizard champion, ends up having to become friends with, work with these other wizards. And I think, you think about why did Dumbledore insist on or make sure that there was a Triwizard tournament then of all times? Well, why? Is because how do you fight Voldemort, whose number one way of fighting against people is to build on their prejudices and their hatreds and all of this stuff? Well, you do the exact opposite. So the Triwizard Tournament is held to try to build the relationships between foreign wizards, between Hogwarts and the other schools, because Dumbledore knows that they are going to need each other. They're going to need to be friends. They're going to need to have allies in the battle that's coming. And that is why there is a Triwizard Tournament in Book 4. And again, one more example of why you have to see these books not as a bunch of single individual little stories, but as one big sweeping saga. And maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more next time. I was thinking about talking about that today, but looks like we're running out of time already. So book five, Harry, experiences prejudice against him, against Dumbledore, against, he hears about prejudice against the giants. Umbridge is a walking bundle of prejudice, obviously. But, he also experiences how bad it feels personally when people treat you that way. We are seeing Harry turning into someone who truly understands acceptance, love, tolerance by being subjected to the lack of it. And so by the time we get to book seven, we are seeing the complete transformation of the Ministry of Magic to prejudice, oppression, Death Eaters and things, but you also see Harry doing a complete change to where he is able to, for example, rescue Draco, which saves the day. He, at the end, doesn't cast a killing curse. Even though we've seen him do a Cruciatus curse, we've seen him do an Imperius curse, we know that he can do, unforgivable curses. It's not so good that he refuses to do them. I think Rowling did that on purpose. I think she on purpose had us see him use those two other curses so that when it got down to the end, we would know, he could probably rustle up an Avada Kedavra if he had to. But of course he doesn't. So again, we're talking about famous wizard cards. We're talking about our way of seeing the whole history of the wizarding world and seeing the way that that informs what happens in the 20th century, in this major turning point, I guess, in history. And I guess we could start talking about that too, but maybe we'll another time. We'll kind of go through the timeline of the 20th century and when people were born and things like this. But we kind of stopped there with 1750. Wow, that's probably going to have to about do it for today. As always, I got tons of notes of things that we could keep talking about. Oh, I did start reading Chamber of Secrets. I got done with Philosopher's Stone. One tiny little detail which came up at the beginning of Chamber of Secrets harkens back to Philosopher's Stone. It's just one of these little trivia things, and I've been putting some trivia on the Facebook fan page, and that's been bumping over to Twitter as well. So Twitter, I'm lexicon_Steve. So if you want to follow me on there, you'll get some little bits of trivia here and there. I've been putting some Chamber of Secrets trivia on there today. But one thing that occurs to me, it says, here's the line is exactly, it says, exactly 1 year ago, he had gotten his letter from Hogwarts. And this is on his birthday, of course, a year later. And I've noticed a few places, comments from people online and things, and I started to realize that a number of people, I think, are of the impression that letters come either on your birthday or on July 31, neither of which is what happened in book one. It did, but not on purpose. I mean, the first one came on, or tried to come on July, I think it's 24. It only ended up on his birthday because of, the Dursleys trying very hard to get away. But so it's interesting. It isn't like it always comes on the 31st of January, of July, or anything like that. But bigger thing, and this is something I was going to try to talk about this tonight or maybe another time, but, I think I may just turn it into an essay because I've been wrestling with this, trying to figure out what Dobby knew. And just read through the beginning of Chamber of Secrets sometime and try to work this out. How does he know that Harry just had a confrontation with the Dark Lord, with Voldemort? I mean, the only person who knows that is Dumbledore. Everyone doesn't know that. They know that he had a battle with Quirrell, but they don't know about... Who knew... I mean, Dumbledore didn't tell Dobby, certainly, so who... How did Dobby find this out? And it goes much deeper than that. I mean, there's this whole idea of what the plot is that he's trying to protect Harry from. So anyway, I've got a whole bunch of notes written down on this, and I think I may end up turning that into an essay and putting it on the lexicon, just to kind of put it out there, and we can talk about it if some people have some ideas. I kind of came up with a theory, and I'll put that in there too, and we'll see how that goes. And I also want to talk about the whole scope of the books, all seven, kind of how they fit together into one story, one two-part story, actually. So we'll try to talk about that next time, too, I think. I guess once again we've kind of reached the end of our time. There's still so much to talk about, but thank you for joining me. It's been another interesting romp through Harry Potter canon. As always, you can head to the website, which is www.hp-lexicon.org, and poke around in there and see what you can find. And you can also, there's a link there to the podcast, and there'll be show notes and links and things like that there for you. You can also follow me on Twitter, As I said, that's lexicon underscore Steve. My email address is steve.lexicon@gmail.com. Feel free to email me if you have any questions or comments or anything like that. There's a Facebook fan page. I'll put a link to it on the show notes. And I guess that's about it. Had a great time Saturday and at the Grapevine Library. I mentioned that before. Just a wonderful turnout. You got to check on the Facebook page. At the end of the time that I had there, one young lady who was in the audience who had been taking notes the entire time. We're talking two lectures, about 3 hours worth of Harry Potter talk. She had been taking notes. She came up and she presented me with a drawing of the Whomping Willow and the car up in the tree there. It's wonderful. And so I had her sign it for me since I was signing a book for her. And I have it. And I scanned it and I put a picture on the fan page. She got to check that out. I thought that was absolutely wonderful. I loved it. Love things like that. Right there just kind of makes the whole day worthwhile. And I have to say it was a little sad. I was doing those talks and thinking, you know, I don't know when I'm going to do them again, because I always seem to do them in connection with the movies. When the movie comes out, the libraries have me come and speak, and there won't be any more movies. And so maybe that's going to be the last time that I do that talk, where we go wandering around Britain and finding the Burrow and finding Hogwarts and things like this. Oh, who knows? Maybe I'll make it to Ascendio next year and I'll have another chance to do them. But at any rate, this is Steve Vanderark for the Harry Potter Lexicon. Thanks for listening.